I'm Nish Weiseth.
I'm Amy Sullivan, and this is Impolite Company, a show where we talk about the tricky subjects polite people are supposed to avoid, especially religion and politics. This week, listeners, Nish finally gets her moment. That's right, Mitt Romney finally announced that he is indeed running for the open U.S. Senate seat in Utah, the one being vacated by Orrin Hatch this year when he retires. We'll talk about how he'll likely present himself to his hopeful constituents in Utah, his combative history with Donald Trump, and the role his Mormon faith will play in his campaign.
We'll also discuss the passing of Reverend Billy Graham, who died this week at age 99. We'll look at his impact as perhaps the most important preacher of the 20th century and the complicated legacy he leaves behind for evangelicalism.
And it's now been 1 week since the school shooting in Parkland, Florida. We'll also discuss whether momentum in the gun debate is shifting, as well as the continuing role religious conservatives play in providing moral cover for the unfettered access to and proliferation of guns. Nish is still holding strong in her refusal to get back onto Twitter, which means Twitter is still Nish-free, and it's worse for it. So to kick off our show, we start with 3 minutes of Nish, in which she gets to unapologetically rage about whatever it is she would have gotten out of her system if she was still unloading her thoughts 280 characters at a time.
This week, Amy, I would like to have a word with the Democrats. So pull up a chair, Democrats, and let's chat. And by chat, I mean, I'm going to need you to just shut up and listen for a second. I need you to stop being stupid. Like, please, for the love of God, stop comparing a Mitt Romney candidacy to Roy Moore's candidacy in Alabama. I hear you guys saying, if it can happen in Alabama, it can happen in Utah. No. No, 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 nope.com, all of the nope in Nopeville. First of all, Mitt Romney is not a pedophile. Full stop. It is widely believed among political strategists the country over that had the assault scandal not surfaced in Roy Moore's candidacy, he likely would have won. Doug Jones didn't win because all of a sudden a bunch of Alabamians decided they love Democratic policies. Doug Jones won because it turned out Roy Moore was a pedophile. It doesn't mean that Doug Jones isn't a great guy or a great candidate or won't do a great job as senator. It just means that the circumstances surrounding the Alabama race were incredibly unique. It was an anomaly. No such anomaly exists in Utah. Not even close. The closest scandal that hit Mitt Romney was when he made his binders full of women remark back in 2012, which, remember that? Those were good times. Mitt Romney is going to win in Utah. So I want you to go ahead and swallow that bitter pill, Democrats. We will talk about this a little bit more later, but you need to go ahead and realize that a female Democratic candidate is not going to beat the Romney machine in Utah. This is Zion, baby, and Mitt Romney was in one of the front rows to the late Mormon prophet's funeral. Like, he is Utah's golden boy. He saved our Olympics. He is widely beloved. His kids live here, and his roots go deep. He got almost 73% of the vote in Utah when he ran for president. 73%. Even some Democrats voted for him, for crying out loud. He is going to win. Stop saying he could lose. He can't. He won't. You're not going to win this one. But with Democrats, what you should do is to start building a strong foundation here in Utah. With the growth happening in the Salt Lake Valley, the likelihood that we could eventually have a Democratic senator grows every single day. It's not going to happen this cycle. But work to start building a coalition and get some ground movement now and build on it in the years to come. And for the love, start talking about religion. But please stop talking about how, since it happened in Alabama, it can happen here. You might as well try to buy your kid a unicorn. It is not happening. And that's my rant. And all of this is a fabulous lead-in, if I do say so myself, to our first topic, Mitt's announcement that he is indeed running for Orrin Hatch's Senate seat here in Utah. Amy, I just want to go ahead and start our discussion by going on record and telling all of our listeners, I told you so. That is what I have to say. And I'm so happy because I was wrong about Roy Moore. And so now I get to say that I'm right about Mitt Romney. I feel like I've got a little bit of vindication.
Yes. Although, to be fair, everybody and their like 6 week old baby knew that Mitt Romney was going to run.
They sure did. They sure did.
Not to like undercut your serious political prowess here, but.
And my prophetic imagination. Just kidding.
Yeah, it was out there.
That's okay.
But I do have to take issue with just one point. Not that I'm not up for a good rant against Democratic stupidity when it's out there. But I would argue that one way to build a stronger Democratic machine in Utah is to run full out as if every race is gettable, because that's one of the huge mistakes that Democrats have made nationwide, is to cede a bunch of races that at the time were pointless. Like, they didn't have any chance of getting those seats. But you don't build a strong bench unless you play as if you've got a chance.
Absolutely. That, yes, I should have said that. I completely agree that one of the ways you do that is run a hard campaign. Go ahead and know that this is probably not your year, but start putting in a ton of resources here. Start putting money behind Democratic candidates in Utah, because it could happen eventually if you start doing that now. But you have to do it now, even though that you're not going to win this time. You have to start sometime.
And I would point out, on religion, it's essential that you're out there every cycle, because otherwise there are a whole bunch of groups who are only hearing from one side and they think you're ignoring them. You're not sitting down with them. You are not listening to them. You're not asking for their votes. And it will make it that much harder to establish those relationships that you really need when maybe the seats do come within play.
Yep, that's exactly right. And don't pander. Like, actually take it with the weight it deserves. Like, actually talk about these things like they matter, because in a place like Utah, it freaking matters. Like, you have to talk about religion and faith in a place like Utah. It's a huge deal. And the more you get comfortable with talking about this with sincerity, the better off you're going to be and the broader your coalition's going to get. Like, it's a win-win for everybody. So, yeah, I completely and totally agree. Run hard at this, knowing that it's likely not going to be the best outcome for you. But Mitt Romney is also older. He's in his 70s. It's a six-year term. The likelihood that he'll run again is, you know, 50-50 after one term. He may just want to get through the Trump presidency. So start building that coalition now with this race. But because you never know what's going to happen in six more years. You just don't know. And now's the time.
Nish, I think we do know. Josh Romney. And after Josh Romney, you've got so many more generations of Romneys. They will never run out of Romneys in Utah.
Romneys
there
and Huntsmans.
There is a store where you can go pick up Romneys and more. If you're out of a Romney, they've got a stockpile of Romneys.
That's exactly right. We have a lot of Romneys. We have a lot of Huntsmans. So we have options, is what I'm saying. But it's totally true. Yeah, it's going to be... We're going to have a long legacy of Romney name in Utah. We already do. And so we'll see how it plays out. But anyway, there's that.
So one of the things we do want to bring up about Romney before we move on, because this could get like our equivalent of thumbs down for the week, is that Romney has, as some people may remember, a bit of a tumultuous history with Trump. Some people think... embarrassed himself a bit in 2012, courting Trump's endorsement, then turned around and called him a phony and a fraud in 2016 when it became clear that Trump was on his way to get the GOP nomination. Then he turned around again and entertained the idea of a cabinet position when he was courted for Secretary of State. And then he's had a few flip-flops since then, Nish.
Yeah, and Romney spoke out really forcefully against the president after the neo-Nazi protests in Charlottesville that left one person dead. And he said in a post on Facebook, quote, "What he communicated," talking about Trump, "caused racists to rejoice, minorities to weep, and the vast heart of America to mourn," unquote. He was referencing Trump's comment that there were good people on both sides at the protest. But then, this week, when Trump endorsed Romney's bid for Senate, Mitt accepted his endorsement. This freaking guy. Like, at the same time, I'm like, okay, I know you have principle there. I know you do. I know it's under there somewhere. I know that there's a backbone. You are not Marco Rubio. But...
And if there's one block of tried and true Republican voters who are not keen on Trump and around whom it would be safe to just hold firm as a never-Trumper.
Right.
It's Mormons.
That's exactly right. And he just, he's just waffling so much. And what it looks like to anyone who is more middle of the road in their politics, which actually is a lot of people, but folks who are maybe just center right, looking at Mitt Romney embracing a Trump endorsement after, like, essentially railing against him for the last 2 years off and on, it feels nothing more than like political expediency. You know what I mean? Like, oh, I'm just gonna try to hedge my bets or like play my cards right or something. But ultimately, you're not like, you're not serving your potential constituents by doing that at all, because the Never Trump movement is really strong here. No one's really stoked on Donald Trump in Utah. And so, I mean, I shouldn't say no one is. There are plenty of people here who are actually quite thrilled with Donald Trump, including our Speaker of the House and our state legislature. So, I don't know. It just, it feels super wishy-washy. It feels like, okay, are you going to, like, align yourself with this guy or aren't you?
Well, and not to mention the one possible positive about running a presidential campaign and losing is that you are supposed to be freed from ever again having to give any flips, as Mitt Romney would probably say.
Like, that's exactly right. Any hex given.
Be his own man. He does not have to care about this stuff, about constituencies and, you know, preserving his ability to run for president in the future. Like, just buck up, Mitt.
Yep, that's exactly right. And here's the thing. It's Mitt Romney. Like, this goes back to my rant. Like, it doesn't matter whether he aligns himself with Donald Trump or whether he distances himself from Donald Trump. As a Republican and as a Mormon, he is going to win no matter what. And so wouldn't you rather leave a legacy or start off your candidacy, start off your Senate career with your integrity and backbone intact? I mean, that's just me. It seems to me like you really don't have anything to lose. Like, you're gonna win. And so what are you risking here? And I guess the pushback I could probably see is that, well, he's ultimately going to be a senator, which is, you know, much different than just being kind of like a GOP kingmaker, which is what he's kind of acted in the last few years. That, you know, the words coming from a sitting U.S. senator are going to be different. There's different weight that's given to them, for sure. And at some point, he is going to be a legislator. And so he is going to have to, you know, work with his colleagues in the Senate, potentially his colleagues in the Senate, to enact legislation that the president will ultimately sign. So he is going to have to work with the executive branch in making Republican policies happen. So I can see maybe the thought process there. But ultimately, when it comes to Mitt Romney and his candidacy moving forward, I really do think that he's really hoping that Trump just doesn't come up. That would be his ideal situation, is that he goes his entire candidacy without even saying his name.
Lame.
Yeah, it was super lame, because it's what everyone else is talking about. But I don't know. I look at the guy, it's just frustrating.
And because here's another thing. I realize he has spent a lot of his life in public service. Not all of it. He made a heck of a lot of money.
Billions.
But a lot of his life in public service. You would think maybe he's thinking a little bit about legacy. Right now would be a really good time for somebody of his stature, who, again, does not have to worry about running for president, already did it, lost, now he's free of that burden, to say, stand up and say he's not going to accept NRA money. That would be really, really nice. The NRA contributed millions of dollars to his presidential campaign. or on behalf of his presidential candidacy. And yet he started out in Massachusetts as really quite pro-gun control, and the NRA was not happy about him at all. And yet, you know, if he's going to flip-flop on, you know, Trump and accepting endorsements from Trump at, you know, the push of a button, push of a tweet button, there's no chance that he's actually going to be that person with a backbone to lead the way for maybe Republican colleagues who have more to worry about. And that's just, it's disappointing because that is public service too. And that would be a legacy to embrace.
For sure. And I mean, the legacy that he also needs to be concerned about, frankly, is the legacy that he's leaving behind for his sons, who also have shown significant interest in getting into public office. His eldest, Josh, who has shown interest in running for governor of Utah. And so when you've got a dad, you know, who has aligned himself with the family name to a president that isn't popular in the state of Utah, and you've got a son who wants to run for the governor of that state, like, that's some careful walk. You know what I mean? Like, you've got to tread carefully there. And so I wonder how much he's going to think about that, too. I don't know. There's a lot of complicated feelings there. But ultimately, I just think we all need to start calling him Senator Romney, because that's what's going to happen. So we'll see.
All right.
But we should probably move on.
Yes. Well, I'm glad that we've gotten the Romney episode out of your system. I'm sure it'll never come up again.
Never. Why would it ever come up again?
We are recording this particular episode on Thursday, February 22nd. Yesterday morning, news broke that world-renowned American evangelist Billy Graham passed away in his home at age 99. Graham was known mostly for his evangelism, and NPR reports he preached to more than 200 million people in 185 different countries during his lifetime. Many of those sermons occurred in massive religious rallies, or crusades, as he called them. Graham was also widely known as America's pastor, having given spiritual counsel to every American president from Harry Truman to Barack Obama. Presidents like Jimmy Carter and Bill Clinton even had interesting connections to Graham. Jimmy Carter worked as an organizer for the Billy Graham Crusades at one point, and Bill Clinton likes to tell the story of sneaking around the corner as a boy to mail his pocket money to the organization after hearing Graham's preaching. He says he thought his stepfather would be annoyed he was sending money to Graham, so that's why he had to sneak out. But really, that's just classic Bill Clinton. Anyway, Graham was also, for most of his life, one of the few figures who was universally viewed by evangelicals as a representative leader. And it's hard to overstate how rare that is in evangelicalism, since there's no centralized structure, no centralized leadership. Billy Graham was one of the few people everybody looked to. One of my friends and mentors, the late Michael Cromarty, used to have a good quip that I love and I'm adopting about how you can tell the difference between evangelical and a fundamentalist. He said, an evangelical is somebody who thinks that Billy Graham is a model Christian, and a fundamentalist is somebody who thinks that Billy Graham is a godless liberal.
That's a good one.
But Billy Graham was both beloved and revered by most American evangelicals, I think it's fair to say. He started Christianity Today, which remains the flagship publication for American evangelicalism, supported the expansion of Christian institutions of higher learning, and influenced the development of organizations like the National Association of Evangelicals and World Vision. But, and there's a but, and I want to say here that I realize he did just die and his family is grieving. But Graham was a significant figure in U.S. history. I think it is fair to say that he was, I would put him with Martin Luther King as the two most influential American preachers of the 20th century. And when someone like that dies, especially after a long life of 99 years, and someone who made very clear throughout his life that dying and going to heaven would be a joyful occasion for him. I think it is both fair and necessary to assess what their impact was. And especially in the case of Graham and evangelicalism in America today, he did as much by what he did not say as by what he did. And I think he, because he did have this rare stature as kind of the one person, maybe Rick Warren approached this a little bit a decade or so ago, but he never got to the point of Billy Graham. He was the one person who could have stood up at some point after the religious right got rolling and said, you know what, guys, no, let's put the brakes on this. And he did speak out. He is on record with some quotes kind of warning people not to enter into a political marriage. But he was the one guy who really could put his foot down and have people listen to him. And that just simply wasn't what he wanted to do. And fair enough. But then you kind of have to own some of what has happened in evangelicalism since then. That was simply not what he chose to do. And I think it is instructive to bring up King as a comparison. Somebody was pointing out yesterday that Graham died at age 99. If he'd lived, Martin Luther King would be 89 right now. And it's impossible to imagine what this country would look like if we had had 50 more years of King's leadership and preaching and activism. But it's also impossible to ignore the fact that he was killed because his preaching, what he had to say, was threatening. And it was particularly threatening to people in power. Now, Billy Graham was a very powerful preacher. And I am willing to believe that he did push the powerful behind closed doors. But what he said publicly did not threaten them. And it's one reason why he was able to have a long, long life and a long, long career, in addition to his race.
Full of access to power.
Full of access to power. Yes. Being able to be that person let through the door to sit down with every president from Harry Truman on. And I just think that's something that evangelicals in general need to grapple with. There were things that Graham did to encourage King, refusing to let his crusades be segregated by seating. Seems like something small, but it made a difference, especially at the time.
It was progressive at the time, yeah.
But I saw one kind of remembrance of him, an analysis that noted that Graham saw not being involved in civil rights activism as something that would give him credibility with Southern governors and mayors, which is understandable. And it's also something that we still hear a lot when people are like, well, maybe I should shy away from being too vocal and visible on this issue because I want to have enough credibility to be able to work with these folks. But I would ask, to what end? There's not a lot of evidence that Graham was using that credibility to preach truth to power behind the scenes or to change things behind the scenes. And sometimes, especially on an issue like race, and I would argue right now, especially on an issue like guns, sometimes you have to stand up and loudly call people out. What good is credibility if you're not using it? And my last comment before I turn this over to you is...
You're doing great. Doing great.
That model, that Billy Graham model of kind of not rocking the boat of the powerful, is something that has become even more perverted in the Trump era. One thing that I've been noticing over the past year, year and a half, is that Trump's court evangelicals are more than happy to claim credit when he does things that they like. So, you know, when he came out last spring and was talking about getting rid of the Johnson Amendment, and
when he appointed Neil Gorsuch.
Right. Expanding. Yes, definitely on the Gorsuch appointment, but expanding religious freedom for Christians. They are so fast to run to reporters and say, yeah, we were the ones who suggested that to him. I talked to him about that in a meeting, and he seemed so interested, and now he's doing it. Look at that. He's listening to us. But when he goes off on Twitter, basically taunting North Korea into a nuclear war, when he goes on a misogynistic rant against women, when he calls people liars, when he is racist and cruel, what they want us to believe is that quietly behind the scenes, they're talking to him about that. They say, oh yeah, we stand up to him on that stuff. We're counseling him, but they claim pastoral privilege and say, you know, it'd be inappropriate for us to talk about private personal conversations with the president. We can't provide pastoral counsel and then turn around and talk to the papers about it, as if that is not exactly what they do when they're proud of
when
what
he's
saying.
When it aligns.
Exactly.
You bet.
So which one is it?
Yeah, they want their cake. They want to have their cake and eat it too, or whatever it is. It's
and that that I really worry is the dirty underside of the model that he started. And it would be unfair to say that is his fault, but you know, he did speak out years later and say that he really regretted being used by Nixon. But I think he needed to stand up as well and point fingers and say, you guys who are doing the same thing now, you are being used. There is just a reticence that I do not understand. Because if you don't say it, sometimes you are complicit in supporting it. And here I look at his son, who... I was trying to do the math this morning, and listeners, I just had an interesting travel experience being on a canceled flight and trying to shepherd two small children across the country. So my brain power is a little limited this morning. But I think it is fair to say that Franklin Graham, given the numbers of people now calling themselves unaffiliated with religion, that he may well be responsible for pushing away as many people from Christianity in the U.S. as his father was responsible for bringing to Christianity. And that would just be the most heartbreaking legacy for Billy Graham, is for that to happen from his own son.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I think that I want to go back to your statements about access to power, and you know, what good is that influence if you're not going to use it, that sort of thing. Billy Graham's influence with American presidents, all the way dating back to Truman, or I shouldn't even say maybe not influence, but at least access, because I think he had more influence with some presidents than others, but he certainly had access. He was a frequent visitor. His counsel, whether or not it was, you know, sincerely sought or not, was still sought after. Billy Graham, for me, truly, he seems to me to be the person who really set up the idea that presidents should have, like, quote unquote, faith advisors. And what that actually looks like and how that plays out. He really was the prototype in some ways for a lot of these things. And for me, I have the underlying question. Is it good for the church, talking about this in a particularly Christian context, is it good for a church that follows, that proclaims the name of Jesus and follows the way of Jesus, who was a man who ministered in the margins and who, you know, advocated for the least of these and was an outcast and was executed by those in power? That's the guy that we follow. What are we risking, and what is the church risking in its like core, in its soul, by allowing or having leaders have that kind of access to truly the most powerful person in the world? And that has always been a question that has kind of like rumbled within me, is to go like, I don't know that even having that kind of access is good for the church. Is it good for the mission of the church to even have the ear of power, or to have even that, like that comfortable or close of a relationship to someone with that much power? And I don't know. We'll never know, because Billy Graham really set the stage for some of these relationships to happen moving forward. And we're seeing the unhealthy iteration of that now, with everything that you're talking about with Trump's faith advisors now, right? Of saying like, oh, they have the president's ear. They're this close to power. We can influence him. But really, they're quick to do it on the things that they particularly align with and not with others. And surprisingly enough, this is just my opinion, but the things that they're not or don't have influence with Trump, or they're not speaking truth to power on, are the things that I really believe are closer to the heart of what Jesus was here to do. You know,
yes, they are not the politics of self-interest.
No,
it's evangelical identity politics. There's no other word for it.
Right. And so there is no like, oh, look at all of these evangelical faith advisors who have access to the most powerful man in the world. And man, they are really advocating for disabled people and the poor. And they are really pushing hard for access to free and affordable health care. They are really pushing forward on restricting access to guns, like, or the death penalty, or like, you name it. There's a whole host of issues that we would look at, like the life and ministry of Jesus and the things that he truly cared about. I mean, specifically the poor, the widow, the orphan, and go like, I don't see these guys talking about any of that. I see them talking about the Johnson Amendment. And so that begs the question, have we actually, and is part of Billy Graham's legacy, is part of it that unhealthy marriage or too close for comfort relationship between the church and institutes of power? And that's something that we're going to have to wrestle with going forward, even though we can look at him and say, oh, he's America's pastor, he gave spiritual counsel and all those things, which are good. I think presidents, if they are spiritual people, should have spiritual counsel in their life. I think that's a good thing. But at what cost, right? What's the cost? And I will go ahead and say outright, I cannot even imagine what that would feel like. Just the intimidation factor alone would require someone very unique to be able to do that. I know a lot of pastors and a lot of people in ministry, and they're all wonderful, wonderful people, but to be the person who would unabashedly be willing to walk into the Oval Office and sit with the most powerful person in the world and speak truth to that person, even if it contradicted everything that they said or believed, would be really, really hard. Like, that is, I cannot think of a harder job, frankly.
It's tough. Yeah, super, it's tough. Not for the faint of heart. That's why, you know, the Martin Luther Kings of the world are, yep, rare.
That's right.
But we remember him in part because he walked up to Lyndon Johnson, and there, I bet, has been no tougher person who has served in the Oval Office than Lyndon Johnson to go toe to toe with and disagree. But he did that. And that is what is necessary.
Yep, it's necessary.
But we are running short on time, and I have to go teach a class. So we will move to our last topic. And really, this is just more of a reminder that we need to be constantly grappling with this, because last week, yet again, America was struck with another school shooting. This one now, the worst high school shooting. Columbine used to be the worst. Now this is the worst. This time at a high school in Parkland, Florida. However, this is not just another time. We are talking about it a week later, and I am almost positive that we will be talking about this a month from now, because the students from that high school have made damn sure that we are going to. That is going to be the legacy that comes out of this. And they are changing the conversation. Trump had to have victims of gun violence in schools into the White House yesterday. He didn't want to do that.
No.
He looked incredibly awkward. He had to have that little cue card telling him to remember, I hear you. Oh, good Lord, man. And, you know, listen to people disagreeing with him, which in his entire 71 years, his life has been constructed so that he does not have to hear from people disagreeing with him.
Yep.
And we both were riveted by the CNN town hall on Wednesday night, where we actually got to see some of these students getting in Marco Rubio's face.
The Rubio dragging was top notch. Just
having
notch.
Him say to them that he could not turn down donations from the NRA. That is the easiest. That was a gimme. Yes, you say yes, of course.
Yep.
What is the downside there, dude? But he couldn't do it. So
just
something
couldn't do it.
Is changing. But at the same time that something is changing, Nish, Christians are still the problem.
Big part of it anyway.
Just this morning, CPAC is going on, and thank the Lord I no longer have to cover things like CPAC. But this morning, the NRA's Wayne LaPierre stood up and offered a very interesting theological take on guns. He said the right to bear arms is, quote, not bestowed by man, but granted by God to all Americans as our American birthright. Which there are so many things wrong with. So
this
many
guy
things
may
wrong.
Be evil
but
incarnate.
What is particularly wrong?
He may be.
It's very possible. Yeah, I like to limit the number of people who I think are absolutely evil, but him and Dana Loesch.
Oh gosh,
I would put the two of them in the same category. But I just wanted to highlight another tweet, because it's not just evangelicals. The folks at CatholicVote.org, who are extremely conservative Catholics, tweeted a couple days ago, definitely after the shooting. Here's the quote. A few points of clarification. One, gun ownership is wholly consistent with the teaching of the Catholic Church. Two, the right to bear arms and self-defense is a right that comes from God.
Can someone explain to me?
All.
Yeah, I was just about to ask. You literally took the words out of my mouth. I was going to say, could someone please point me to that scripture? Because I'm afraid I missed it in all my years of reading it.
Yeah, that must be one of the missing Ten Commandments, because
it's not there.
Ain't there.
And here's the thing. We are not going to overturn the Second Amendment in this country. Not going to happen. And so this idea that, like, we're, by calling for stricter gun laws, by calling for an assault weapons ban, so a ban on a specific category of firearm, that somehow we are taking away a person's right to own a gun is a, what we call a straw man. Like, it is, that is not the argument that we're making. And so you do not, like, you don't, I mean, if they actually do believe that God gives people the right to bear arms and own a gun, that's an entirely different situation and entirely different conversations we need to have.
Yeah, they're not talking about a constitutional right. They are trying to elevate this to a God right. given the, inalienable this is, right.
Like, what they're saying is life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and an AR-15. Like, that's what they're saying. And it's fundamentally not true. Like, it's just not true. And
to hell with your right to be able to go to school and not be slaughtered by an AR-15.
That's exactly right. School, a movie theater, to work, a nightclub. I mean, you name a concert outside. You could. It is happening in every single public place in America. Almost is not immune to a mass shooting anymore. It has happened everywhere, absolutely everywhere. In churches, which we saw in Sutherland Springs, Texas, not even what, 3 months ago?
First grade classrooms.
First yeah. grade babies. Little babies.
Yeah.
It's just, it is
terrifying.
I can't. If I had enough bandwidth to come up with better vocabulary, I probably would. But the only thing that I can seem to say is that I can't think of something more deeply heretical and contrary to the heart of God than God does. You don't just have the right. And so if life, liberty, pursuit of happiness are the things that we say are inalienable rights given to us by the Creator himself, the right to bear arms, to use a weapon of death and destruction, that God delights in that, in giving us that? Like, no, that is so fundamentally not true. It is inherently not true. It is contrary to who God is. It is contrary to the ethics of the kingdom of God. It is contrary to who Jesus is, who said, lay down your sword, turn the other cheek. I could go on and on and on and on and on. But the truth of the matter is that these people, whether or not they believe it or not, if they believe it, that's one thing. But they don't actually even need to say it out loud because they're creating an argument that no one is making. No one is telling people that we want to confiscate all of your guns. That is a straw man argument that is used by the NRA and the far right side to say, you're not going to take my guns away. Okay, well, no one wants to take your guns away. That's literally not on the table. We are not going to overturn the Second Amendment. We are not going to start walking around door to door confiscating everybody's guns. That is not reality. People are not actually having this conversation in any realm of reality. And it is one of the things that has been so hard, both for me personally and to watch other people engage, is to go, we are talking past each other because we're actually not talking about the same thing. And one of the things that I loved last night at the CNN town hall with these kids These kids are fundamentally going to change this country. I really do believe it. It's not going to happen overnight. It's going to take a while, but they are not going to forget. And they are turning into voting. They are growing into voting age, and they are going to fundamentally change this country over time. I really do believe it when it comes to guns. But the thing that I loved last night was watching these parents and watching these students and these teachers confront NRA spokesperson and Marco Rubio and their legislators, and watching them finally put their feet to the fire in such a way that they weren't able to skirt around the issues anymore and create straw man arguments quite the same, because these kids were not having it. They're like, no, that is not what we're saying. We're asking you about very specific legislation, about this very specific piece of policy to do this one specific thing to keep us safe. These people were not able to circumvent the argument with all of these other crappy non-existent points anymore. And that was one of the most wonderful and fascinating things to see last night, was to watch these kids finally say you don't get to skirt this issue anymore and create this horrible straw man argument that we're not even talking about. We're talking about this one thing, and so talk to me about this one thing. And they were standing there face to face, and they couldn't get away from it anymore. And it was amazing to watch. I know you and I texted when it was happening. We were both just riveted, watching it happen.
It was something.
It was incredible. Yeah. It was absolutely incredible.
Well, and we are going to keep up this conversation. Just to bring it back to Billy Graham, I want to point out that Before he died, Religion News Service had put up a piece that was about his granddaughter, Jerusha Armfield.
Oh, yeah.
Her husband is a Baptist pastor, and she herself has been very outspoken. And she's been taking on her uncle, Franklin Graham. And what is fascinating is she is an alumna of Parkland, the high school in Parkland, where the shooting took place.
Oh, really? I did not know that piece.
Yes. Wow. And she's been talking in the past week about guns in particular. And I want to see if we can have her on because we got to have a shift. And maybe the students are the ones who can push that overall, but we still got to have a shift within evangelicalism or it doesn't take. I'm just afraid it's such a big block of Americans, and it, particularly in the regions of the country that are so resistant to changes in gun laws. So I just want to keep harping on what we can do to reach fellow evangelicals on this, because I think it's a Bible issue.
Yep, sure is.
It's a life issue. But Nish, we've come to the end of this week's show.
That's true. We have. And to wrap up the show every week, we like to leave you with a recommendation, a TV show, a movie, maybe some music, a podcast, a book. Amy, what do you have for us this week? What'd you watch? What'd you listen to?
That is a good question, Nish.
What did you do in your lovely time in Arizona on vacation?
What did I do? I read...
Besides chase children.
Yeah. I read James and the Giant Peach to our children. And I am so pleased to report that they were riveted. I was so even good. Able to compete with Caillou episodes on the tablet, which...
Caillou? Amy.
Yeah. Yeah, we have a four-year-old. He's still loving Caillou. But
Caillou's the worst.
Our daughter had the chance to either read a little bit more of Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix or to have me read aloud some more James and the Giant Peach, and she chose James and the Giant Peach.
What? Yes. Your daughter, the Harry Potter fanatic who wants a real wand?
Yes.
Wow.
That's very excited about that. So, yeah, I would not say it's pop culture recommendation, except if you've been sleeping on James and the Giant Peach, maybe pick it up again. We're going to have to read it again.
That's Roald Dahl.
Or we're
going
to have to watch the movie. It is Roald Dahl, who I love.
Yeah.
And the only thing is, good. I love, we were like halfway through the book, and our little four-year-old looked at me and he was like, wait, they are inside the peach? I was like, buddy, that's the whole book. What did you think was going on?
Newsflash. Welcome to the plot, little buddy.
I love these little four-year-olds so much. He's so into it. Every chapter I'd be like, should I stop? And he's like, no, keep going. Aww. Like just riveted and yet totally not understanding what was happening.
So funny. I love that. That is just the best. Have you introduced them to Matilda yet? Matilda's my personal relative.
Oh, I have never even watched or seen Matilda.
Oh, you need to
I've been saving it to do with them. So we may have to move on quickly while we've still got some momentum. Also, Fantastic Mr. Fox. Those two are going to go boom, boom in a row.
And you got to watch the movie. You gotta watch.
Which I also have not seen. I figured all these great kids movies came out, but I thought I'm gonna see them 10 billion times.
Yeah. And it's Wes Anderson, who I love. Yes. And it's George Clooney, who doesn't love listening to his voice all day.
All right, so Nish, what about you? Please tell me you had more exposure to pop culture than I did this week.
Just a hair. I am packing up my house. Don't forget I'm moving. So I have had a little bit of exposure. I did watch the Chris Rock special on Netflix. I wanted to report back on that. It is super funny, but please know it is Chris Rock. So if you are not familiar with Chris Rock's comedy, it is very harsh language.
A little blue.
Yes. So just be mindful. It is definitely HBO level. So if that is not your comfort zone, then I would not watch it. But it was really, really great. I loved, he was really sincere. He actually went through a divorce in the last year or two. And so he was really honest about that and open and honest about why his marriage failed. And I mean, he obviously made some jokes about it because he's Chris Rock, but it was really sincere and honest. It was a new side of him that I hadn't really seen before, which was really fascinating to watch. So anyway, that was really good. But I have to say that the newest season of Last Week Tonight with John Oliver is back. Mm-hmm. And his most recent episode, the season premiere was this last weekend on Sunday. It comes out on Sunday nights on HBO. You can also on Facebook, if you follow The Late Show with John Oliver, or the not Late Show, Last Week Tonight with John Oliver, Late Show with Stephen Colbert, they usually post his like deep dive. So the main story for the week, they post the entire video on their Facebook page. So if you don't have HBO, that's a good way to catch up on like what he actually talked about during the week. I love John Oliver. The people that he has working for him, his writers and reporters, are brilliant, like just brilliant. The things that they uncover and the things that they talk about are just incredible and fascinating. And obviously John Oliver with his really funny British accent makes his delivery he just has pitch perfect delivery. So anyway, really funny, always great to watch. Also crass, it is HBO, so be mindful of that. But it is back and I'm super happy about that because it's one of my favorite news commentary shows that is on the air since Jon Stewart retired. So
excellent.
Yeah. So that's back. Okay. Well, that is all for this week's episode. Thanks for joining us. Impolite Company is produced every week by Constantine Hios. If you've enjoyed our conversation, please, please, please rate us on iTunes. It's the very best way to let other people know about us and expand these conversations. And as always, we will post the show notes on our website and on our Facebook page, Impolite Company, the podcast. Until next week, have fun storming the castle, kids.